people. We all stand on each other's shoulders. We're all part of a web of media. But I think that taking some of the innovations that Jenka made in terms of the American Legislative Exchange Council coverage before the live election night coverage last year, the year before, to really build out that community and make room for more people who maybe want to come in here, learn these tools, and go out and make their own podcast or have shows on their own. We also have a website, a new website coming live, I believe in January, unless something wild happens. That guy blows up a bomb outside of Mars. What was that about? Anyway, there are people out there doing wild stuff, but I really like to bring back to the grassroots and look at, hear the voices that we don't hear on some of our other stations that we respect also.
Well, that's it, everyone out there. You have received the formal invitation now. Come down to KBOO, get involved. We would love to see you and hear your voices here on the air. We are out of time for News on the Boot. Lisa, thank you very much for coming in today.
And
we look forward to seeing you in the new year. Mike, thank you as always. And we look forward to seeing you in the new year, which is coming up day after tomorrow.
That's right. So be safe, everybody. And we're going to talk to Pamela Santos, another hire coming into our membership department next week. So thank you, Aaron and Brian. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website. And make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running from January 15th through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image, music and culture. Opening night, January 15th, will be Roxy the Movie, directed by Frank Zappa. Filmed over three nights in December 1973 at the Roxy Theater in Hollywood, Roxy the Movie encapsulates the qualities that made Frank Zappa a revolutionary musical pioneer. That's January 15th at 9:15 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Here at KBOO Portland. Up next is Occupy Radio. Regardless of what you may have heard, we're still here.
The news and opinions expressed on Occupy Radio may not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Oregon or the associated students of the University of Oregon.
From Pacifica Network, this is Occupy Radio, covering stories of resilience and resistance, integrating activism into our everyday lives.
The seeds of the Occupy movement were sown when Wall Street crashed the economy and then got bailed out. That was the climax of a concentrated 40-year-long campaign to gut the middle class and transfer the wealth of America into the hands of the wealthiest 0.1%. 7 years after decimating the American economy, it looks like the wealthy class can justifiably hang a mission accomplished banner from their penthouse balconies. Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies joins Occupy Radio to share the new report, Billionaire Bonanza, the Forbes 400, and the rest of us.
Hello and welcome to all of our listeners, wherever you're listening from. I'm your Occupy Radio co-host, Rivera Sun, talking with David Getchy, Sierra Lupe, who we like to call Getch, out there in Eugene, Oregon.
Howdy, Rivera. Howdy, Occupiers.
We're headed into a new season with new co-hosts, new characters for each of us. I'll be hosting Love and Revolution Radio with Sherry Mitchell. And Getch has a bunch of surprises up his sleeve, so stay tuned for all those updates.
Right, right. Yeah, I was talking about doing a student debt show, and we do talk a bit about student debt in the show this week's show, and mostly focusing on Chaos Theory Radio,
which airs every week through Occupy the Media Collective, going out on our podcast site Tuesday mornings. You can catch Chaos Theory Radio. Well, there has been a lot of chaos, that's for sure, out there in the world this week. The French Assembly has declared an extension of the state of emergency for the next 3 months. 3 months of a state of emergency, which is essentially somewhat like martial law. You know, there's a good line of questioning going on about, you know, this didn't have to happen after Charlie. It's now happening after this one. Why? What has shifted? And, you know, people should know that this is not a minor thing that's going on. The police no longer need warrants for conducting raids. They have been lining diners up at gunpoint, just in case they think there's a security threat at a restaurant, particularly Muslim restaurants, particularly Middle Eastern food they're using this on. There are soldiers on the streets with submachine guns patrolling the areas. They're raiding mosques. This is, if we aren't paying attention to this, I think we're really doing ourselves a disservice.
I feel like this is the major story of the week. It exceeds what might happen at COP21 because even though everybody's pumping it up, there's still relatively low hope for what is going to come out of the climate talks. But the whole idea, imagine in America if police only needed justifiable suspicion in order to raid your home. You know, kind of dandelion insurrection sort of changes would that mean for us?
Well, let's hope, like in my novel, The Dandelion Insurrection, we do see both the dark side and the bright, courageous side of resistance, that when we are confronted as citizens with these actions by our government and our military, we need to resist them. It's actually our I hate to say it, but like almost patriotic duty. If we care about our civil liberties, if we care about freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, our rights to privacy, our rights to protest, then we have to assert them in these times of crisis and challenge the security state, which is rising up and actually clamping down on what we call democracy. Now, we always like to point out every time we use the D word that we don't actually have democracy in the United States. Even our former president, Jimmy Carter, has said we no longer have functional democracy at this time. So that caveat aside, even some of the functions of democratic society, such as protest, gathering, speech, assemblies, freedom from persecution for your political beliefs, these are the things that get swept under the carpet when we get afraid of terrorism. And many people are saying, and I think this is a good point, Getch, that ISIS and terrorism has won when we give up on our civil liberties, when we allow ourselves to be terrorized into these behaviors of allowing security culture to run our lives and the security state to have total control over our lives, rather than we, the people of a democratic society and a theoretically democratic nation.
Well, you know, I think it's worse than that, because it's not that ISIS and terrorism have won, but the desire to move so immediately to crack down on civil liberties and to crack down on freedoms by the French government today, by our government when they nearly unanimously passed the Patriot Act 13, 14 years ago. The fact that we can move so easily in that direction almost is like collusion between the terrorists and our fascist governments. You know, we're going to talk with Chuck Collins today about how the wealthy are ruling the world. And this strikes me as just how they work hand in glove with terrorists. You know, it's not necessary to take away all of our freedoms because these bad things happen, but it's a lot easier for the people in charge if they can do that.
Well, look, we have our African-American populace under constant terrorism and assault from our own police departments. You don't see any of these politicians getting up and declaring a state of emergency because our African-American citizens are being killed. This is, I mean, there are so many levels and layers of racism in the whole dynamic around security state and terrorism. I mean, not just the rather blatant and obvious racism that occurs towards Muslims and people of Middle Eastern descent, immigrants of all kinds, but also in the way that we apply the word terrorism and terrorist, that it's really not ever applied to our white shooters, our white male shooters who come from a very particular demographic over and over and over again, and who are pretty much ascribed as mentally ill. I'm not, you know, arguing that they're, I consider taking a gun out and shooting numbers of people with mentally ill action. But I do think the way that we're using the word terrorists and applying the word terrorism has a lot of political connotations steeped in racism, steeped in prejudice and bigotry and bias. And, you know, you really got me rolling, Getch, as you can tell. I'm very fired up about this. I think this is one of the most important issues of our times, that we not surrender on this as citizens, but that we defend our democracy by asserting our right to these civil liberties, by which I mean the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment particularly, and to really stand up for ourselves as people and to not be terrorized either by our own state governments or by terrorist groups.
And the people who will always benefit when terror increases, when the clampdowns happen, when the ability to protest in the streets is taken away, the people who will always benefit are always the people at the upper level of the economic structures. And we're going to talk with Chuck Collins this week on just that point. All right, Occupiers, another return visit, this time from Chuck Collins, who is the senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and a co-editor of inequality.org. And as of today, with Josh Hoxie, Chuck is the co-author of Billionaire Bonanza, Forbes 400, and the Rest of Us. And that, I imagine, is going to be quite an eye-opening study and quite an eye-opening conversation. Thanks, Chuck, for joining us here on Occupy Radio.
Great to be with you again, Getch and Rivera.
Chuck, you know, this is a really fascinating study, and I feel a little bit privileged to have gotten it a leaked copy early, which Getch hasn't even gotten to see yet, although I did send him the talking points. This is a pretty damning report. This is a new study. This is up to date. So, Chuck, why don't you tell us just what this report is telling us and why it's important?
Well, we took a look at the Forbes 400, which is an annual list published by Forbes magazine of the wealthiest 400 people. But we also looked at the new survey of consumer finance data that looks at the wealth of everybody else. And we just kind of put together some interesting juxtapositions. I mean, you've probably, you know, if you think back to the Occupy moment when people were talking about the 1% or 99-1. And what we've seen in a very short time is the wealth just keeps concentrating at the top. And the share of wealth and income keeps funneling faster and faster. So, you know, here are just two of our findings. One is that the Forbes 400 now, and people, a couple of years ago, people said, you know, the Forbes 400 has more wealth than the bottom half of the population combined. Now it is the wealthiest 20 members of the Forbes 400, enough that could fit on a Gulfstream 650 private jet. 20 people, 20 individuals have more wealth than the bottom half of the population.
You know, that's about 150 million people.
That's right. About 152 million people, 57 million households. So that's how lopsided we've become. And the share of wealth that goes, you know, owned by that Forbes 400 now is equal to about 62% of the whole U.S. population. So if you think of the pie and the portion of the pie that's going to the very top, not talking about the 1%. We're not talking about the 0.1%. We're talking about 400 individuals. That piece of the pie just keeps growing.
It almost, you know, especially with COP21 going on right now, this is maybe a good comparison. Right now with climate change, we talk about how we're into this almost irreversible climate changing loop. And I just wonder, have we reached an irreversible wealth inequality loop, feedback loop in America right now?
Well, I think that's an important parallel, Getch. I think that we're seeing kind of a system breakdown, both in the ecological area. The fossil fuel industry is sort of on a burning carbon, doubling down, building new infrastructure as fast as possible. In the same way, we're seeing the concentration of wealth, the system failure there, where more and more wealth is going to fewer hands. So I think there's an interesting parallel there of an overall system breakdown.
Chuck, can I ask a idiot's guide to wealth question? So, you know, we all hear from our parents, money doesn't grow on trees, but this concept of the Forbes 400 and the top 0.001% or whatever they are just amassing more and more wealth. This isn't just like new money just miraculously appearing on the scene, right? This is coming from somewhere. And if that's true, where is it coming from?
Well, I think you can see, you know, particularly in the top 20 and the top 100, there's a fair amount of what we could, you know, I'd be able to identify the brands through which this wealth has come. A lot of high tech and finance, but, you know, you see Facebook and Google and Oracle and Microsoft. So you see the sort of the wealth that's come from sort of the new technology. Jeff Bezos is now number 4 on the list from Amazon. But then you also see, sort of old wealth, inherited wealth, the Mars candy family, you know, folks who make your Snickers bar. They've been on the list since the beginning. They're now, I think, the fourth generation of a candy company. The Walmart heirs, the sons and daughters and spouse of Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart. There's 5 of them on the Forbes 400 list. So you see a mix of new brand name wealth, if you will, as well as old wealth. But in every case, you know, some of it may be first generation, some of it may be old. In every case, I would argue that this wealth has been greatly aided by the ways in which the rules of the economy have been tilted in the favor of wealth at the expense of workers and wage earners. Meaning,
I guess that's the question I was really driving at there is, are they sucking up the wealth from the workers, the low wage workers, we know the middle class is virtually a myth at this point. Have they amassed the wealth of the middle class, or has the wealth of the middle class gone overseas, or both?
Well, I think that there's the squeeze that's on the middle class, which shows up in the form of either wages sort of staying low. So that's sort of the Walmart economy, you know, that has been very good to people who are shareholders, who own wealth, who see their value of their stocks expand. So I think that the middle class squeeze, we can see that that's part of the wealth funneling up. It's a global squeeze. So there are whole regions of the world that have had their natural resources extracted without much in return. That's funneled to the top. So it's definitely a sort of global trend, and there's definitely kind of a hoovering of wealth from the top, you know, vacuuming up, suctioning up wealth from working class and middle class and low income families. Every time you pay, a particular charge on your phone, or at the global level, if you're a cell phone. If you have a cell phone in Latin America, every time you make a call, you send a nickel to Carlos Slim, the wealthiest man in the world. You know, you can sort of see the connection.
I'm curious, Chuck, about maybe you could give us a little bit more info about the conditions that wealth is created. We hear a lot about quantitative easing, and the number that comes up most often is $80 billion being pumped into the hands of Wall Street and the wealthy every month for something like 4 or 5 years. What does that mean? And is that real? Are those just numbers on a ledger? You know, it's all digital and doesn't really mean anything. It means something. But I mean, what's going on with quantitative easing? And is that the mechanism where all of this wealth has been able to aggregate upward?
Well, you kind of raise an important question here, which what is this wealth? I mean, there's a huge amount of wealth at this level is paper wealth, is claims against the labor and the value of others. We've had this, you know, since the economic meltdown and even before, but really for the last 10 years, we've seen this policy of, you know, kind of zero interest loans to large financial institutions. I mean, backing up, these institutions were about to collapse. And we did a fair amount of direct bailing out, you know, actually giving cash to private banks and others. But the other big way that the government stepped in to help them was basically lower their borrowing costs to zero so that they could lend money to the rest of us and just make a lot of money. And that was a way to kind of help these big behemoth financial institutions regain their solvency. So it's been a tremendous subsidy for the wealthy and for the people who own these large financial industries. So in that sense, it's been a way to prop up and expand the enormous wealth that flows to this group, of which a lot of their money is in the form of financial wealth. It's not in land or houses or, you know, real goods and assets. It is in the financial netherworld. It's claims on vast deposits of wealth.
Is it almost fictional?
Well, as long as everybody believes it, it's real. The more, you know, until people start to say, well, you know, this claim doesn't have legitimacy. But yeah, it's real in the sense that they can now, you know, one of the things we write a lot about in our report, Billionaire Bonanza, is not only is this wealth being created, but it's also now being hidden. It's being shipped off to offshore accounts. It's being hidden in these kind of very complicated trust mechanisms that people create to pass wealth on to their children. There's a huge amount of hidden wealth. What we're talking about really is the visible part of the wealth economy. There's a huge kind of invisible shadow side to it as well.
Chuck, you use a really interesting metaphor in the report, or a really interesting concept in the report of the Forbes 400 could all fit in the Seattle Space Needle, which made me imagine a Forbes 400 party in the Space Needle. And looking around the room, there's some pretty notable trends. Number one, not only are they all wealthy, obviously, but they tend to be extremely white and extremely kind of overwhelmingly male. I think there's about 57 or so women on the Forbes 400 list. What can you tell us about particularly the race? Because I did go to the Forbes 400 and do all their search engine sorting functions, which include women, which include industry, which include name and family and business. You can search them out by those indicators. But interestingly enough, the Forbes 400 list does not allow you to search race. So what can you tell us about the Forbes 400 and race?
Well, we know that there are two African-American people on the Forbes list. One of them is Oprah, and the other is a technology investor named Robert Smith. So those are the two only African-Americans on the list. There is another African-American billionaire, Michael Jordan, but he only is worth $1.3 billion, so he didn't make the cut. only time in his life he didn't make the cut.
Poor Michael Jordan.
In terms of Latinos, there are five Latinos on the list. One of them is Jorge Perez, who's a huge real estate investor in Miami, the condo king of Miami. And Arturo Moreno is a billionaire billboard operator, owns the Los Angeles Angels baseball team. The other three Latinos are all from one family, and they're kind of recent citizens, meaning they're Colombian, all born in Colombia. They were part of a huge beer company, Sab Miller. They're big sort of investors in beer. And so three of them are recent Latino immigrants to the U.S. And wealthy because of a inherited beer connection. That is it. I mean, there's I haven't calculated the number of Asians. There's both globally and within the U.S., probably 15 to 20 Asians on the Forbes 400 list. But as you say, it's largely white. And you can sort of see, you know, this is where the sort of legacy of race and wealth building is. It's another place where it shows up. And you can see, you know, intergenerational advantages, you know. So even though, you know, they're on the Forbes 400 list, maybe, a fifth of the people there are now inherit their way onto the list in some way. And a lot of them are what I would call born on third base. You know, they're kind of like Donald Trump, you know. Yeah, he's on the Forbes 400 list, but he's there because his father had a very substantial real estate company and he got a significant head start. It's not like he sort of started life in the batter's box. He was literally born on third base. So there's a fair amount of those, and you can sort of see the legacy of race and racism in wealth building, even at the very, very top.
I think there was one more statistic that's worthy of mentioning, which is that the Forbes 400 now own about as much wealth as the nation's entire African-American population and more than a third of the Latino population combined. That, I feel, is one of the most shocking and heartbreaking facts about that, knowing the struggles and the sufferings that are going on within the Latino and the African-American populations, and also looking at this enormous disparity that happens around wealth and class. And
come get within a rocket ship, dimensions of a positive invention that is monstrous. I'm giving in my all, it's just my sentiments evolving as I give in to the power of just living in the now, not for the dividends. I holler from the spirit within all of us. I'm drifting on a cloud up in your mental, feel the shower, follow in as I devour y'all with synonyms and vows. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our time to dig within the tower over ignorance. The final hours here, so come and crowd around and listen up at how I'm staying driven by the sound. I feel it lifting higher, how my daily living is. The styles are like my children, see them scour through the villages. And counting when the gift is in the house, I bring the lyrics that come down from up inherited, the sound from a mysterious, profound, very indigenous way out deep inner vision. And I think I really.
It was very striking. That's probably one of the most damning features of the report to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way quite stunning if you, and again, a couple of years ago, we did a little analysis that showed that the Forbes 400 had as much wealth as the entire African American population. You know, which is like 16 million African-American households. And then as we did this recalculation, we realized now it exceeds that dramatically. And it's essentially a third, about 5 million Latino households. So, you know, that's, you know, and again, you can sort of, we have this legacy of racism in wealth building. You know, most wealth for ordinary people is in their home. To the extent, if you own a home, that is the way in which you accumulate and save. And after that, you have financial investments. but very, very few, a small percentage of African Americans own their home compared to whites. Like almost 72% of white Americans own their home. The home ownership rate has actually gone down pretty much across the board, but it's down to 42.4% for African Americans, 46% for Latinos. So that's how people get on the wealth building train, as they purchase a home. And then ownership of stock is incredibly skewed. 55% of white households own some kind of stock, but less than a third of African American households and about 17% of Latino households own stock. So, you know, for the bottom 80%, very few households actually have any financial wealth at all.
So, you know, Chuck, the show is Occupy Radio for another month, and the Occupy movement came about largely because of the crash in 2008, 2009, and the understanding that the explosion of the wealth gap was, becoming a problem for our economy. And it seems to me that as good a job as we did of getting the public conversation to start focusing on the wealth gap and all of these issues, we didn't really do anything to slow it down. Do you have a sense in the last 4 years of how much this gap has grown?
Well, I think that at the very top, you're right. I think that the value of the Occupy movement was really putting the whole issue of inequality on the agenda. And if you think about right up until this moment, I mean, now the conversation about inequality is so much more robust. It's much more in the political debate. You have Republican candidates for president decrying the growth of inequality. Candidate Bernie Sanders has really made this a central point of his campaign. And if you can't read the news online or in a newspaper anymore without just sort of seeing how these inequalities are this huge undercurrent. Yeah, and I think the point of our report is it hasn't slowed. It's actually concentrating more. We know that really since the economic meltdown, almost all of the income and wealth gains, all the growth since 2008 has gone not to the 1%, but the 1/10 of 1%. The 115,000 households at the very top are the ones that have captured almost all the income and wealth gains since the economic meltdown. That is staggering. And I think our report is just to show that it's even more skewed the higher up you go up the space needle. The more skewed it is. So I think that's the dizzying part of it. It's just it continues to concentrate at the top.
You're listening to Occupy Radio from KWVA Eugene and the Pacifica Radio Network, streaming at kwvaradio.org. and podcasting at occupyradio.org. And we'll come back and talk with Chuck Collins about more of what's in this new Institute for Policy Study report, Billionaire Bonanza, after we take a quick break to explore a few other layers and dimensions of this. You know, Getch, money's important. It affects all of our lives. And mm-hmm. I think most of our listeners are falling into the category of people who will not be in the Seattle Space Needle in the Forbes 400 dinner party. We may have one or two out there. If you are out there, I hope you're very inspired by this show to actually address the issues of wealth and income inequality. We're going to talk a little bit about that with Chuck after this little interlude. But, you know, you brought up an interesting question to me, Getch. How much of our lives is determined
by the wealthiest 1%. Like, if we took them out of our entire existence, not through violence, but maybe a lovely desert island with, you know, pina coladas and whatever they need, but just said, you may stay on your island, but you may not take our money out of our communities, out of our families anymore. You may not influence our political structure, and you may not run our media anymore. What would our world look like?
I would think that initially we would face austerity. I think that we'd face a certain level of deprivation, though I don't know that it would really increase that much, because the, you know, Chuck will clear these matters up for us a bit, but I don't think the wealthy with their money have a big impact on our lives already. We talked with Chuck after the interview, and we couldn't quite parse that out. But I just feel like if we could just put the wealthy on reservations, okay? You know, we'll just tell them, hey, you've got reservations. You know, they'll be like, oh, we like reservations. And we just put them on the reservations and say, okay, you stay there. You do your thing over there. You don't mess with our politics and everything. I think eventually, just like public banking, you know, we would begin to build up our wealth again, and we would have control of it until a bunch of us rose to the top and seized it, and then we had to put them on reservations.
Now that's a very interesting problem that we're looking at, that to actually address the issues of wealth and wealth concentration, we also need to address the culture that gives rise to the permissibility of wealth and wealth concentration. As you said, I mean, this is a very typical pattern of both armed and, I mean, violent and nonviolent revolutions, that, you know, the group that comes into power after ousting the former group very quickly assumes some of the worst attributes of the group they've just ousted. And I think that's very important to note, that we have seen this cycle with wealth before, and we're going to see it again if we don't address the root of who we are as people around the issue of money and wealth. And I think that's a long topic, a long subject of discussion, but something each one of us needs to sit with as we're talking about how to end the concentration of wealth, this extreme concentration of wealth. How are we also ending the inequality and injustice around wealth that exists within our own hearts and our own ways of behaving in the world?
We need to just stop looking at wealth, and we need to, you know, I'm not a real fan of money, to tell you the truth. I'm a lousy businessman. I give away far too much of my labor, but in general, I'm happy with my life. You know, I unfortunately raised my kids in poverty, and I'm sorry to my children for that, but I don't really feel like I need the billions of dollars. I don't think my life would be changed. And, you know, Rivera, are you familiar with the optimum income for happiness?
Isn't it around $50,000? Isn't that what Mr. 70, Gravity...
70 to $80,000.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, because there...
Which would be a step up for many of us. Whew. Most of us, probably, according to the statistics. Being your not quite starving novelist over here. Uh-huh. You know, we get it. I think a lot of our listeners get it, and even those who are not within the poverty spectrum also really understand the struggles that many people are going through. But I think this thing that you're bringing up is like, who would we be without money? Are we happier as billionaires or even millionaires? Or can we actually find equality and justice and happiness are very tied together for ourselves and for our communities?
Well, I think the main thing is if you're happy, if your needs are met, and every day when you wake up, you know you'll be fed, you'll know you'll have a home when you're done, you'll know that if you get sick, you'll be taken care of, then money isn't important. It's all of those things that are important. But let's explore this a little bit more with Chuck Collins for the last part of the show, and he'll give us a lot more info on these facts.
The median income is under $50,000. And actually, the median income has pretty much stayed flat or gone down over the last decade. The median wealth or net worth is $81,000. And that includes the wealth of the very wealthy. So that includes, you know, so half, you know, the median point is 81,000. That's savings, net worth, home equity. So half the households in the United States have less than $81,000 in wealth to fall back on, and half the households have more.
So that's like if Bill Gates walks into a homeless shelter, suddenly that homeless shelter has an extremely high net wealth.
That's right. It is pulled up by the richest one, you know, well, up the ladder, up to, say, the 1%, pulls up that median wealth. One of our points is that for those of you who are cat lovers out there, this is the time to pay attention. The number, if you took the, you know, 36 million households with that typical median amount of wealth, $81,000, that's the amount of wealth that the Forbes 400 has. 36 million typical U.S. households with that wealth. That is the same number of households that own cats. 36 million households in the United States own cats. Some of them have more than one, obviously. Some have 20. But anyway, that is...
So it's kind of like if you imagine all the households that have cats, which, I mean, that's almost everybody I know, right? That's the equivalent wealth that the Forbes 400 is holding in their accounts and their investments. That's pretty remarkable. I mean, that's a wide swath of wealth that they have amassed for themselves. You know, we talked a little bit about this runaway wealth cycle, just like the runaway carbon cycle, or the climate cycle. And, you know, Thomas Piketty warned about that in his recent book that everybody claims to read, but probably very few people have actually read the whole thing. It's rather thick. But, you know, that wealth right now, there is no check on the wealth cycle, and that the wealth cycle is actually driving itself into a peak of wealth concentration. And, you know, I don't remember what his take on what the resolution of that is going to be. I imagine economic collapse is one of them. Total revolution is probably another distinct possibility, because when people can't survive, they've got to do something to bring it back. I mean, Nick Hanauer has talked about the pitchforks are coming. Occupy talked about the non-pitchforks are coming. what's your take on how we can get ourselves out of this vicious cycle?
Well, Your point, Rivera, is important. That what Thomas Piketty said is we're kind of left alone. If we just allow this sort of a runaway wealth cycle to continue, we basically will have a society governed by a hereditary aristocracy, meaning the sons and daughters of Facebook and Microsoft and, you know, Google will become the ruling classes. That will be a society ruled by wealth. And that left alone, that's where this happens. So what we're documenting in this concentrated wealth is just sort of, this is the machinery now, or the cycle. So Piketty's proposal was a global wealth tax. He believes that that's the intervention that would actually reverse this. And we agree, you know, it has to be global, because wealth is global, and it's, you know, quickly escaping national regulation and taxation. We believe, you know, that you can do things like raise the minimum wage, you can institute campaign finance reform, but if you really want to reverse this wealth concentration cycle, you need to tax wealth at the top. And I mean, here's a radical proposition. Why wouldn't we institute a 100% tax on wealth over $1 billion? Let's start with that. I can make a fairly good argument for taxing it. But, you know, if you've got $1 billion, anything above that belongs to society, the society that helped create the fertile ground that made that wealth possible. And let's use that. Let's deploy that wealth to expand the commonwealth, to expand the infrastructure, and let's use some of that wealth to address the climate crisis and help us with a transition to a post-fossil fuel economy. That, you know, even if we were to levy that, that would generate $2.3 $1 trillion of revenue if you just levied that tax. That's, you know, a lot of money, and it would still allow these 400 people or 500 billionaires in the United States would still have $1 billion, more money that they could spend or their children could spend in their lifetimes. And so anyway, that's just a thought piece there. Somebody's got to say it. And I think that's that's the key intervention around the runaway wealth cycle.
Bill O'Reilly, on the other hand, is going to come back to you and say that all of the job creators and innovators will no longer have any reason to job create and innovate because they can't enjoy the fruits of their labors.
Well, there, you know, first of all, we're all job creators. I mean, people at all different levels are contributing to the economy in a way that contributes to jobs. There's a little bit of this mythology that if you have a huge mass of wealth, that makes you a job creator because you're investing capital. That isn't necessarily true at all. In fact, a lot of capital at this level, at the very high levels, is invested in speculative gambling ventures that are not in the real economy and that actually could potentially hurt the real economy. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, you know, if you think about, well, what does it take for people to have an incentive? You know, $1 billion? after $1 billion, you're just kind of keeping score. You know, it's all very abstract. $1 billion, if that's not if you tell me, Getch, oh, I can't have $2 billion, so I'm going to just stop playing. You know, I'm not going to stop being interested in being engaged in the economy. I don't think that's the case. I mean, we know that's not the case.
Well, I think one of the other comebacks to always have in your back pocket for the Bill O'Reillys of your world, the middle class small business owners are actually greater job creators than the wealthy class. And remember that if you're a like $5 billion billionaire, how much of your billions are you actually investing in actually creating jobs? And conversely, if you have $5 in your pocket and you hire somebody to mow your lawn, you're investing all of your wealth in creating jobs. So, you know, it's an important thing to remember that by the numbers, small business owners actually do create more jobs. And that the problem we're looking at is the concentration of wealth, which has actually been a great detractor from a widespread swath of the populace having access to capital to actually participate within the economy and be those so-called jobs creators.
That's a very critical, important point, is these concentrations of wealth actually distort the real economy. They actually undermine the healthy functioning of commerce. So there's nothing kind of virtuous or healthy about these levels of concentrated wealth or a rigged economy that sort of, you know, allows it to continue to function this way. And this is what's interesting. You're starting to see more and more people. I mean, I'm connected to this network, the Patriotic Millionaires, where you start to see even people who are, you know, the tremendous beneficiaries of this economy see that there's something wrong with the way the rules are rigged. And see that it actually undermines healthy capitalism. That's their goal. So you have a pretty wide consensus of people that see the dangers of these concentrations of wealth.
Chuck, do you think that the 1% gets this? I mean, we know like there's Patriotic Millionaires, which is great. And then if the 1% gets it, we should talk about our other members of the 1%, i.e. our special friends out there in Congress. Do they get it? Are we likely to see them pass any sort of progressive legislation on these issues short of, you know, full-scale nonviolent movements for change, pushing them to?
Well, you know, I think that there's a very small segment within the very wealthy, the 1%, say, that think that these inequalities are good in some way. They think that they actually create incentives or whatever. I mean, even the Forbes 400, they surveyed them. Is inequality a serious societal problem? 76% of the Forbes 400 said yes. So there's a pretty wide recognition. There is this segment I would call them the rule riggers, that, you know, think the Koch brothers or the casino mogul, you know, Sheldon Adelson. They use their wealth and power to rig the rules of the economy to get more wealth and power. Actually, there's an interesting article in Monday's New York Times about the state of Illinois and how in Illinois, you know, a bunch of basically multimillionaires and billionaires got together to take over state government. They ran one of their own super wealthy guys to become the governor of Illinois, and now they're pushing for a set of public policies to squeeze, you know, government and squeeze workers and cut, you know, austerity budgets, the whole bit. So that is a good example of a segment of the 1% using their wealth and power to get more wealth and power. But the vast majority are kind of sitting it out, or they're engaged like the patriotic millionaires on the other side. They're kind of pushing for greater equality, greater fairness, expanded opportunity for people who are not wealthy. It's a bigger segment than we think, which is good news, I think.
You know, Chuck, I'd like to give you a chance to hit some bullet points that you haven't hit yet from this study. But I have one last question before we go in that direction. And, you know, we could go other directions as well. A lot of times when I hear discussions of wealth distribution, the discussion goes in terms of how much wealth circulates in a community. You know, I guess before it gets hoovered up into the 1/10 of 1%. My understanding is, you know, small businesses, local small businesses, wealth that they create circulates within the community like 7 times or something like that. Say Walmart, any wealth that Walmart creates doesn't circulate. Can you illuminate that point for us?
Well, if you think a healthy Main Street oriented economy, people say that a dollar spent stays in the community, you know, 6 or 7 transactions, you know, and that is because a lot of local businesses do business to business between each other, you know, so you buy a cup of coffee and then it goes over to the local coffee roaster, and the local coffee roaster spends it at the local hardware store, and the local hardware store spends it over here. And so in a healthy, vibrant local economy, money sort of stays around. In an economy where there's a lot of absentee ownership of businesses, the dollar leaves the moment it leaves your wallet. It's gone from the community. If you go around certain neighborhoods, you see, wow, look, almost all the businesses here are chains. Or they're the cell phone company, the shoe store, the restaurants, they're all chains. They're all owned by global conglomerates. You spend a nickel there, that nickel is on its way out of the community. So I think that's the key point. And this is another reason why Rivera's point about small businesses not only are the engines of job creation, they actually are part of how money stays in the local community and creates a vibrant local economy. So I think more and more we have this kind of predatory, extractive Wall Street economy that is goal is to extract wealth from workers and communities and local economies. And we're up against that, you know, and our part of organizing is to protect the local economy from those extractive forces by supporting, you know, buy local campaigns and supporting local enterprise and supporting business, local business to business work. And that's why these local first business networks are very, very important, because those are the people who are most committed to a local economy.
Well, Chuck, you're in good historical company. When Gandhi was trying to liberate India from the British, one of the main points of strategic intervention was with local economics. Oftentimes we hear of this as constructive program. There's a couple other words that were used for that. But local economics were extremely important in ending the occupation of the British Empire. In fact, they were Gandhi was very successful in actually dipping right into their pocketbooks and putting it back into both the movement and the local communities, which were very intrinsically entwined. So I think if we're looking at an occupying power of extremely wealthy individuals and corporate state, which, you know, always is a fun topic to talk about, that local economics is a keystone issue for all of us who care about income inequality and wealth concentration to actually address in our own day-to-day lives and to organize other people to also engage in. Is there anything in the study that you think we should cover in our last few minutes of the show, Chuck, that we haven't gotten to touch on already?
No, I think that the conversation we're having is great because I think that part of it is people are saying, well, golly, these are large mega trends. Do these matter? Is there anything I can do about them? You know, supporting a local vibrant economy is one of the ways that we push back against these inequalities. It's how we build a movement to protect the local real economy from the predatory extractive Wall Street economy. I mean, the other reason that, you know, I think when we talk to people and they say, well, does this really matter? I mean, does it really matter that, you know, 400 people have so much wealth? Well, it matters almost in every way you can conceive of it. I mean, it's obvious that it affects our democracy. There's a, you know, recent New York Times report that's 158 wealthy donors have given half of all the money in the current presidential, the 2016 presidential campaign. Half the money has come from 158 families, and about two-thirds of those are families that are in the Forbes 400. So that's a group that's using its disproportionate wealth to influence our democracy. You know, some of that money maybe goes to Democratic candidates, very, very small amounts of it, actually. And Bernie Sanders is the only candidate who is running that's not accepting money from the billionaire class. So democracy is one place, but it touches every aspect of our life. Housing costs, if you think about what's happening in cities and communities around the country and how wealthy investors are bidding up the cost of rental housing and homeownership, putting it out of reach of working families, that's a way in which inequality touches our lives very, very directly. And on down the list. I mean, even people who are, you know, will say, well, geez, what about, does this matter? Does this affect opportunity? Does this affect, you know, if I'm a working class kid and I'm starting out in my career, does this inequality matter to me as I venture forward? It absolutely does, because societies with grotesque levels of inequality have lower social mobility and lower opportunity for advancement. And part of that is that the wealthy are kind of pull up the ladder. They literally stop spending and making investments in public infrastructure and education. They stop they lose interest in the rest of the society's advancement and take their money and their power and go somewhere else. And that the societies that have less inequality, like Canada or Scandinavia, now have more social mobility than the United States.
So we're talking about the new study from the Institute for Policy Studies, the Billionaire Bonanza, Forbes 400, and the rest of us. We're recording this in advance of December 2nd, but the report comes out on December 2nd. And Chuck, we're just about at the end here, but I want to make sure if there's any bullet points that you haven't hit in this study, I'd like to give you, you know, a chance to hit those now.
Well, I would just underscore how wealth is concentrated so quickly at the top. You know, that in 1982, when Forbes started their list, there were 13 billionaires in the whole country. Now there are 545. Went to join the Forbes 400 list, you needed $75 million, which is essentially about $185 million in today's dollars. Today, you need $1.7 billion to join the Forbes list. So we're talking about just the wealthy taking off at the top, taking a larger percentage of the societal wealth. So I would encourage people to sort of to learn more and actually check out the website inequality.org or visit the Institute for Policy Studies and see the full Billionaire Bonanza report. We're going to start doing these every year to correspond with the publishing of the Forbes 400 list. We'll do an annual comparison of how their share relates to the rest of the population. But it's relevant to all of our lives and what we care about, really.
Well, thank you so much, Chuck, for joining us on the show and giving us this important information and letting our listeners know the other side of the Forbes 400 list.
Thanks for having me.
Wow. So what Chuck has to say is so important all over the place. And this is our second time on the show, and I wish the show kept going so we can have him on again. But thank you to Chuck and Rivera. Thank you, as always.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to get on the air with you, Getch. Occupy Radio is produced on the campus of the University of Oregon, and we thank them for all of their support. We are syndicated on the Pacifica Radio Network, which means that your local radio stations can carry us. And I always like to thank my co-host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
That's right. That's right. And occupiers, like I said earlier in the show, keep on reaching out because we're still there. But in the meantime, you can drop us a line at OccupyRadio23 on Twitter and Gmail. We're Occupy Radio on Stitcher and iTunes. You can find us on Facebook at the Occupy Radio group page. And we are OccupyRadio.org.
For Occupy Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. In 1982, the year I came into the world a little prematurely, redheaded and squalling, you needed $70 million to get on the Forbes 400 list. That's about $146 million in today's money. Well, I'm now 33 years old, listeners, and in 2015, it takes $1.7 billion to qualify.